This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Josh Rothman. I write about technology, among other things, for The New Yorker, and I edit a lot of our tech stories. Anna Weiner is a contributing writer who worked for a few years in tech. She has a new book called Uncanny Valley. It's a memoir of her years before she became a journalist, working for startups in Silicon Valley.
San Francisco was an underdog city struggling to absorb an influx of aspiring alphas. It had long been a haven for hippies and queers, artists and activists, burners and leather daddies, the disenfranchised and the weird.
A lot of writing about technology takes place in just a few locations. A boardroom where a deal is being struck, or a garage where coders are working on some new project. Anna's writing is different. It's cultural. It's about what it's like to live and work in Silicon Valley, and about how the culture of the valley shapes the technology that all of us use. Anna was there when the reputation of Silicon Valley took a nosedive after revelations about Facebook and other issues. And she has an unusual perspective, because she didn't think of herself as a techie. She's both an outsider and an insider.
The city, trapped in nostalgia for its own mythology, stuck in a hallucination of a halcyon past, had not quite caught up to the newfound momentum of tech's dark triad. Capital, power, and de bland, overcorrected, heterosexual masculinity. It was a strange place for young and moneyed futurists. The pleasure center of the industry might have just been exercise. People courted the sublime on trail runs and day hikes, glamped in Marin and rented chalets in Tahoe. They dressed for work as if embarking on an alpine expedition. High-performance down jackets and foul weather shells, backpacks with decorative carabiners. They looked ready to gather kindling and build a lean-to, not make sales calls and open pull requests from climate-controlled open-plan offices. They looked in costume to LARP their weekend selves.
When did you first get to San Francisco? What was it like?
I moved to San Francisco in the spring of 2013, so April. And so I was staying in an Airbnb in a bedroom in a loft in SoMa. And I realized not quickly enough that it was actually owned by one of the founders of Airbnb. So this was sort of like my first introduction to like startup Disneyland, which is what San Francisco really started to feel like. The CEO of our company was 24, and he had started the company at 20. I think that I felt that this was anomalous to a certain extent, to have a CEO who had no real work experience prior to this position, who was figuring it out as he went along, as we were all growing up, as the company was growing up. I thought that that was really unique to this company. And then as I got a little older and I got to know more people who worked elsewhere in San Francisco or Silicon Valley, the extent to which we had almost identical experiences with someone who was just learning how to manage with with a lot of capital in a fast-growing company and young employees who also didn't really know what they were doing. I don't know. There was a lot of, like, being pulled into conference rooms, a lot of mind games, a lot of sort of behavior that I now understand as, like, a need to maintain power in a workplace, because there was this, like, you know, a lot of his employees were older than him.
Right.
But at the time, I just thought I had just, like, found a completely unusual environment. And it felt so improbable. It felt so improbable that this company was making something that was wildly successful and had fundraised $12 million and that this should be working.
So part of the mythology of Silicon Valley companies is that it's completely different. It's like a whole new way of doing business, and it's a whole new way of running a company. And you're throwing out all of these fusty rules and inherited hierarchies that are basically dopey. How much did you find that to be true?
In a lot of ways, it's cosmetic, sort of superficial. The way that I wrote emails in publishing in a tech context looked like I was crazy.
Say more.
All my emails in publishing were like, I'd be like, "Dear Josh, hope you're doing well. Here's a little call back to the last time I saw you. How's your mother? I was thinking of you the other day because I came across this book, and on page 43, there was a description of whatever. And by the way, I have this favor to ask of you. I'm so sorry. I know you're really overworked, but if you possibly have time to do this, also I need to cancel our lunch. With warm regards, can't wait to hear from you, like fondly, Anna." In tech, the email has no punctuation. It's all lowercase, and it just says, "Do you have that report?" And so as someone who was coming from this like really florid communication style to this really fast, truncated communication style, that was really jarring, and it was also so exciting.
Yeah. Could you say a little more about exactly what the skills were that you had learned? They were like technical skills?
So the company I worked for, I don't think we've even mentioned this, was a data analytics company. So I could sort of look at a block of code and see how our product had been implemented and understand how that had been done or done badly. So if you had something like Seamless and you wanted to implement this data analytics tool, it would allow you to track all of the ways someone behaved with that app. So if someone is searching for Thai food, which restaurants they click on, which dishes they add to their cart and then remove, what time it is, where they are when they're doing this, if they close the app. And so the idea was to track engagement rather than what had sort of been the industry standard, which was like the equivalent of page views.
Right.
This was to see what are people really doing inside of, on websites or inside of apps, and not just that, but in what order, and how can you then kind of optimize people's behavior to achieve whatever goal you have inside of your app.
So interestingly, you sort of found yourself, it's like the part of the valley that now we are extra freaked out about, I guess, which is like this idea that when we open up an app or when we use a website, we're being like tracked and sort of maybe like manipulated in some way. Is that accurate? And did it feel weird that you could see all this data about people's interactions?
It feels weird now. At the time, I found it thrilling. I thought it was fascinating. I honestly think that it taps into this feeling of that if you have a lot of data on what other people are doing, that really feels like knowledge. And it feels, there's something a little bit secretive about it. There's something, it's sort of like you're behind the curtain. It didn't feel like surveillance at the time. It felt like understanding how people were engaging with digital products. And that to me felt like sociology, or it felt sort of like anthropology in a way.
Sure.
Every month or so, we'd have like a happy hour for customers, and they would come to our office, and there would be all of these snacks and a lot of booze and beer and wine, and customers would come from other startups. And the team I was on that kind of encompassed client-facing roles was called the solutions team.
Right.
So the solutions team would sort of sit around our laptops and help people solve their problems over a beer. And we would all, everyone in the company was supposed to wear the company shirt. So we were all wearing t-shirts that said, "I am data driven." And I have to say, it was hugely gratifying to meet people who were using the product, who had problems, and I could solve them. And there was no other part of my life where I was like, I can fix that. I'm highly competent.
Right.
I have specific knowledge and can be like a little bossy about that.
So while you were working at the analytics company, Edward Snowden leaked from the NSA all this information about how much data was being collected and the fact that the government was looking at it. And that must have had an impact of some kind.
I think in general that Snowden was sort of a moral test that Silicon Valley kind of failed, just because I'm not quite sure what came of it. And so it wasn't until a coworker of mine actually sort of put together the dots and started to suggest that perhaps the product we were working on was tied to the surveillance economy, and perhaps this concept of a neutral platform didn't quite hold water. I think I really only personally, like, I had drunk the Kool-Aid so significantly that it took someone from the inside to tell me what we're doing ties into these bigger political and economic forces that are not morally neutral.
Yeah.
And for me now, one of the biggest things that I think we need some regulation around is who can see data and where it's going when it's getting collected. So, like, if you're using, again, to use a Seamless app example, if you're using Seamless, you probably are aware in 2020 that they're collecting some information on your use of the app, but you don't know as a consumer, because of the way this technology is designed, that there are third-party tools that are also collecting data that are potentially then being shared with even more companies, or that at these companies that run these third-party tools, that there is someone like me who can see it.
Right.
So it just got me thinking a lot about employee permissions and access, and just that there's no transparency around who has data, who owns it, what it's being used for, to what ends, how long it stays on a server, where does it go?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like dust.
Yeah. So the perception from the outside, the way we talk about Silicon Valley has changed a lot in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess since Trump, since 2016, not long ago, basically the concept was, you know, this is amazing and tech is amazing and Silicon Valley is incredible and we're really proud of it. Now we talk about it like it's super dystopian. There's these manipulative overlords. And we see Silicon Valley as like this deeply money-motivated place that's like screwing up our democracy. What was your experience of that shift?
Yeah, I mean, largely it's a narrative shift, right? I don't think that anything changed in terms of the concentration of wealth or power or what enabled that concentration of wealth and power. Everything has been in place structurally for decades to facilitate that. So I think it is more just the story that the industry was telling sort of was accepted whole cloth and for a long time by the media. And then around 2016, with the presidential election, there was all of a sudden this sense of shirked responsibility and a lack of accountability, and people felt lied to. And I think that also there was had sort of been in large part a failure on the part of the media to take the industry seriously, to treat it as like the sort of powerhouse it had become.
Like it was still kids in the garage. And
yeah.
When I think about what your book is about, you know, and the book is called Uncanny Valley, and it evokes in that title the idea of a thing that presents itself as one thing but doesn't quite, it isn't quite what it aims to be. And I wondered, I mean, is that right? Is that how you experienced that time? Do you think tech sees itself differently now than it did a few years ago? Or is that something we're doing from the outside?
I'm not sure that the increasing amount of criticism or critique of the industry has led to a ton of introspection. I think if anything, it has led to a lot of defensiveness. I think people are really reluctant to relinquish this narrative of being underdogs, of being innovators, of just trying to experiment and make the world better. I think that the most honest and like the healthiest thing that people can do is just acknowledge that these are businesses, mm-hmm. not cults or or like mission-driven nonprofit organizations or something.
So you know, you moved out there in a state of relative, you were innocent. Do you think now, if you read your book, do you think you would say, I want to move out to Silicon Valley?
I'm worrying that people listening to this conversation are going to think that they should move out to Silicon Valley. It's incredibly expensive. I don't recommend it. I don't know how people will read this. I think we're in a moment where a lot of industries are struggling. There's sort of like an institutional erosion in many areas. I think that these are some of the best jobs people can have in terms of compensation and job opportunity and not needing to have any particular degree or expertise. You can sort of just jump into a company and wiggle your way up the ranks. I think the popularity of the industry in terms of for people who are looking for jobs, it has to do with, it's a response to other structural factors that make Silicon Valley really appealing.
Yeah.
And so my focus would actually be on, like, how do we make it such that this isn't the most viable option for someone with a need for security or for a job that doesn't require an advanced degree.
Yeah. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Anna Weiner is a contributing writer who covers Silicon Valley. And her book, Uncanny Valley, is out this week. The book has already gotten really spectacular reviews. You can find an excerpt from it at newyorker.com. She spoke with Josh Rothman.